I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. This hour of the program, we're going to be talking about the life of the most photographed man of the 19th century. He was born with the name Frederick Augustus Washington Bailey, born a slave in Tuckahoe, Maryland in February of 1818, and he became a true leading abolitionist and a women's rights advocate and one of the most influential public speakers and writers of the 19th century. Frederick Douglass is the man we talk about this hour, and we'll have two guests with us. A little later in the hour, we'll be speaking with a great-great-grandson of Frederick Douglass, Kenneth Morris Jr., who is the founder and president of the Frederick Douglass Family Initiatives. We start the hour with David Blight. He is a professor, historian at Yale University, director of the Gilder Lehrman Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition, where he organizes conferences and lectures. He's writing a full biography of Frederick Douglass, and the story of how he happens to be doing that is interesting. The papers that he found, which nobody had seen before, who was going to write a history, they're going to be published early in 2018. He's the author of Race and Reunion, The Civil War in America, American Memory, which received all kinds of book awards. And he also wrote the introductory essay of Frederick Douglass's second autobiography. We'll be welcoming phone calls for both gentlemen during the course of this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well at K Dunn Show. Professor David Blight, thank you very much for being with us. Hi.
Hi there. Thank you, Kathleen. Good to be on.
Yeah, good to have you here. I know that I've read mostly about your thoughts concerning Douglass and the relationship with Lincoln and the Civil War in the 1850s, but if you don't mind, let's start with his early life just to refresh everybody's memory, or maybe some won't know very much about Frederick Douglass, because the early story, and it's a very important story because he was born a slave.
He was born a slave. His mother was a slave woman named Harriet Bailey. He never knew to his dying day precisely who his father was, but his father was a white man and likely his first owner, but we don't know that for sure. If it was his first owner, it was a man named Aaron Anthony, who was a good deal older than his mother. But he was raised as a child, largely by his grandmother, a woman named Betsy Bailey, and he was born in or around her cabin at a horseshoe bend in the Tuckahoe River in 1818. And he spent 20 years as a slave, much of it out on the very rural eastern shore of Maryland. But to his great good fortune, a good deal of it as well in Baltimore. He was sent to Baltimore by his owner, second owner, Thomas Auld, originally to be the companion of a white boy, his nephew, named Thomas Auld, Tommy. But it was in Baltimore that Douglass learned to read and write, got involved in churches, got involved in a debating society, discovered the Columbian Orator, this amazing manual of oratory. Saw the great ships in the harbor, saw and talked to sailors, found newspapers and so forth. It was his good fortune to be in Baltimore because it was from Baltimore ultimately at the age of 20 where he escaped from.
Mm-hmm. And where he finally goes back to, you remind us, and meets his wife, doesn't he?
Yes. Well, he doesn't go back to get
his
wife, but he sends word. He sends a letter, which is read to her. She was about 2-3 years older than Douglass. But when Douglass arrived safely in New York City after a couple of days of sleeping among the barrels by the docks, he finally reached safe haven in an abolitionist home. And he wrote to her, and she was ready and packed to go. It was just as much bravery on her part as it was on his to get on a train and then a steamer and a ferry boat and get to New York City, where they were then married in the home of David Ruggles by a former fugitive slave himself and a minister named James Pennington.
Hmm. So where is it that he, was it self-education, much like Abraham Lincoln, that he gets the music of the words? Because he was such a brilliant writer and an amazing orator. Where did that come from?
Well, there's a little bit of mystery in it, as there is for all great writers. But for Douglas, we know that he first learns his letters from his mistress in Baltimore. Her name was Sophia Auld, teaches him to read and write, read the Bible with him. And he had an insatiable desire to explore language. He collected newspapers. He gets it also from this remarkable little book called The Columbian Orator, which was a school reader. He managed to get his own copy when he was about 12 or 13 in Baltimore. And it, among other things, it was a collection of Enlightenment-era speeches and a book, a kind of a manual about how to do oratory. But then he also learned language in black churches in Baltimore.
Huh.
And when one gets serious about reading Douglas, whether it's his autobiographies, and he wrote 1,200 pages of autobiography, or it's his speeches and his editorials, you begin to realize he wrote in a kind of a King James prose. He wrote in a sort of sermonic kind of prose, which is the way he spoke it. And it's in part, I believe, because he came by language by hearing it first, by hearing it from preachers, and by hearing it in churches, and even by hearing it in the streets. But he came to love words, and eventually as an abolitionist speaker and writer, and indeed edited his own newspaper for some 16 years, words became essentially the only weapon he really had.
Mm-hmm.
They were his power. They were his mode of persuasion. And he was a genius at it. Now, part of it also comes, though, from sheer practice. No one is born an orator. They have to learn to do it. They have to practice it. And by the time he goes public as an itinerant abolitionist speaker in 1841, he was out on the circuit 100 times a year, often, giving lectures, giving speeches, sometimes in just town squares or out in parks or in churches or in halls. And he became especially effective in those early years at the kind of abolitionist lecture that pointed at American religious and political hypocrisy. He was brilliant at that.
Mm. His first autobiography, A Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, an American Slave, 1845, described as an immediate sensation.
Yes.
Why? And was this news to people?
Yeah, well, it was not the first slave narrative by any means. There had been slave narratives before him, but his was the most powerful and the biggest selling and the most influential, in part because it was the best written. Douglas had an amazing story to tell of his slave youth, and he told it with great detail, using the real names of all these people he encountered in Maryland, and we've verified virtually every name in that book. But he also had a way of telling it in a form that 19th century readers loved. It was a kind of ascension story. He was rising from the depths to something higher. He was overcoming the hell and the prison of slavery to something called freedom. He was defeating a system with his own individual will. He portrayed himself as a of self-made hero. Americans loved that story. But Americans were ripe as well. Readers in the North, at least, were ripe by then. This is the mid and late 1840s and early 1850s. They were ripe for stories about slavery because slavery was the biggest issue in America. It was becoming the political issue that was tearing apart the political system. And we know that especially because of the great popularity of Uncle Tom's Cabin, which came out in 1852. In some ways, slave narratives like Douglass's narrative paved the way for the great success of Harriet Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Hmm. You talk about 1851 to 53, I believe you say, as being crucial years, the civil rights decisions during that time period, so crucial in Douglass's life. Tell me about those.
Well, the early 1850s is a transformative time in American political history, and it was surely transformative in his life. The Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 is one of the most important markers. This was the federal law passed as part of the Compromise of 1850 that made it now mandatory, if possible, that fugitive slaves be captured and rendered back into slavery by a federal judicial process. It threw fear and dread into northern communities. It sent upwards of 20,000 free blacks living in the north into Canada. It led to, in 1851, 2, and 3, it led to numerous rescues of fugitive slaves who had been captured. Famous ones occurred in Boston, in Syracuse, and all across the north, out in Oberlin, Ohio, and many other places. In Douglass's case, it's a transformative moment, though, because he is undergoing his own personal and ideological change, tremendous change. He got his start in abolitionism under the tutelage of William Lloyd Garrison, the famous Boston and Massachusetts abolitionist. And Garrison was a hero to him by any stretch of the imagination, even a father figure. But also Garrison was a doctrinaire kind of anti-slavery advocate. He believed you must use certain strategies and certain strategies only. For example, he was anti-political party, believed you should not get involved in politics. He was a strict pacifist. He did not believe in the uses of violence. He believed the U.S. Constitution was utterly complicitous with slavery and should be denounced. And there were many other elements of Garrison's approach. Well, Douglass, about 10 years younger, goes to England 2 years in 1845-47. He comes back. He moves out to Rochester. He forges his own new newspaper called the North Star. He becomes more independent. He comes to believe that without some use of violence, slavery may never be overthrown. He comes to believe that the Constitution has to be something you can use and not just denounce. He comes to believe that the political system has to be affected and changed. And he and Garrison underwent a terrible breakup in the early 1850s. And it's a pivotal turn in his life because Garrison had been like a father figure. He'd been his ideological father. He found a home in abolitionism under Garrison's tutelage, and now that was gone, and he was on his own. But ironically, he also did his greatest work in the early 1850s. He wrote his greatest speech in 1852, which is his famous 4th of July speech, the most in-depth and remarkable critique of American hypocrisy you may ever read. He also wrote his only novella called The Heroic Slave in 1852. And then in 53-54, he began to write his second autobiography, which he would then publish in 1855, called My Bondage and My Freedom, which is his long-form masterpiece. It's a much more political autobiography. It's a much angrier autobiography. It's much less moralist and much more aimed at the great political issues of slavery, and it's much, much more revealing about his early life and the 10 years since he wrote the first memoir. So, and Douglass also, by the 1850s, has become a newspaper editor writing his own editorials. He mastered that short form of the editorial, and he is constantly out on the road giving speech after speech after speech against slavery, and engaging by then the great political crisis of the expansion of slavery.
Mm. Was he afraid for his safety?
Yes, indeed he was. That didn't mean he stopped, but he had every reason to be.
I imagine.
He was attacked many times. And in fact, the Garrisonian abolitionists were too. One of their aims was to stimulate crowd responses and crowd hostility. And they certainly succeeded at it. Douglas, any number of times, had bricks thrown at him, had stones thrown at him, fruit and eggs thrown at him. One time he had a live pig thrown at him.
Oh, my.
Up on the altar of a church. You know, it was a part of the landscape. One of the remarkable things about that, this kind of violence that was conducted against abolitionist speakers, it's remarkable in those years that people tended not to carry guns.
Mm-hmm.
And the attacks were never with guns, which today we might even find surprising. I mean, some abolitionists to some people were, you know, dangerous threats to the social order. But they didn't seem to bring guns to these events and rallies, but they would certainly throw objects at him.
I've heard you talk about his relationship with Abraham Lincoln, and you say that 2 months following Lincoln's inauguration, Frederick Douglass was demoralized by the president's policy, and he was exhilarated by the outbreak of war at Fort Sumter.
Yeah, he was. Yeah. People who love Douglass also have to love the fact that he welcomed the war, and he became a virulent war propagandist. He was deeply disappointed during the first roughly year of the war with Lincoln and the Lincoln administration because they did not move directly against slavery in the first year of the war. It wasn't until the summer, really, of 1862, and then in the fall of 1862, that Lincoln took real public steps against slavery. But it was very hard to wait for that if you were Douglass, because Douglass, like most black Americans, saw Fort Sumter and the outbreak of war and then the formation of these huge armies to make war. They saw all of this as now a war that should be fought against slavery.
Mm-hmm.
In order to defeat the South, they already saw you had to crush slavery itself, the social system, the labor system, the economic system. But that took time for a whole lot of reasons, but that took a good deal of time. So in that first year of the war, right on up until early fall, 1862, Douglass was a ferocious critic of Lincoln. He changed his tune, though. First with the Preliminary Emancipation Proclamation in September of 62, and then particularly after the final Emancipation Proclamation of January 1, 1863. Those documents and those enactments brought a new hope, a new faith, that somehow, as Douglass used to say so many different ways, that somehow now the cause of the slave and the cause of the Union could be molded together, could be joined together. And that is eventually, of course, what did happen. One could argue it happened by necessity. One could argue that it happened in part by will. It happened because of both. And by the third and fourth year of the war, Douglass was not only a supporter of Lincoln's, but a pretty strong supporter of Lincoln's, especially of his re-election in 1864.
Mm. Let's talk a little bit about that election, then we'll go back to, I want to talk about his involvement in the 54th Massachusetts Regiment, too. But this election of 1964, I've heard you talk about this, that it was just an incredibly, what you've called it, the most racist, white supremacist election in history.
Well, it was until then, and it indeed it was. Lincoln runs for re-election in 1864 in the midst of all-out civil war. It's the only time that we know of that a republic tried to hold a general election in the midst of civil war. But Lincoln runs for re-election. There was, for a while, a move within the Republican Party to dump him from the ticket. There were those who wanted to support John Fremont, who they thought was more radical, more anti-slavery. Douglass never really joined that. He stayed in Lincoln's corner. But by the middle of that summer of 1864, as the election campaign takes hold and Lincoln does get the Republicans' nomination, the war is in a horrible state. It's in a stalemate in Virginia. It's in a stalemate in Georgia. And the scale of casualties and the scale of war weariness has become horrific across the North. And there were many Northerners who wondered if this kind of bloodshed was any longer worth it. And Lincoln really believed he might be defeated that fall. I mean, he really came to believe he would be defeated by George McClellan, of all people, who was the Democratic candidate and former Union general. And the Democrats ran an openly racist campaign against Lincoln. They painted the Lincoln Republicans as this danger to the Republic because they were the emancipators. Emancipation was going to ruin the country. It was going to ruin white society. It was going to ruin the Constitution. It was painted as a dire threat to the very meaning of the United States. They called Lincoln Abraham Africanus the First. They called him the N-word lover, and on and on and on. And in that circumstance, Republicans, under such duress, and we've seen this in our politics too, haven't we, under such attack for being so favorable to blacks and their liberty and their rights, they backed away a bit. They would not allow Douglas, for example, to go out and campaign for Lincoln. And Douglas deeply resented that. Now, the election was absolutely pivotal. If Lincoln doesn't win re-election in 1864, if the Republicans don't continue to control Congress and the presidency, the war itself, the emancipation policy, which has been in place now for a year and a half, hundreds and thousands, indeed, of slaves have been freed into the Union Army, into contraband camps and other facilities. If Lincoln doesn't win re-election, the war would have a very different outcome, and everything was at stake. And when Lincoln did win in the fall of 64, he won in part because they let soldiers vote at the front, and at least most states did. And Lincoln won something like 76% of the soldiers' vote.
Amazing.
Which shows that the soldiers, at least, they knew what they were voting for. They were voting to continue to prosecute the war to end slavery. Douglas saw Lincoln's reelection, November 1864, as equivalent, and this is the metaphor he would use when he went out to speak about it. He saw it as equivalent to the end of the flood in Genesis. Mm-hmm. And he would tell the story of Noah's Ark and how Noah would send the dove out. The dove came back with a twig in its beak. And then Noah sent the dove out again, and the dove did not return. And then Noah took the tarp off the ark, and there was the green earth reborn. This was where did Douglas go to understand the meaning of that particular political moment? He went to the oldest story of rebirth in Western culture, Noah's Ark. And it shows us not only a lot about how Douglas came by ideas from the Old Testament, but how important he saw Lincoln's reelection.
We're going to welcome him a couple of phone calls for our guest. We have two guests this hour, and here's how you reach David. Our number is 800-486-8655. David Blight is a professor of history at Yale University. He's director of the Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition. He's currently writing a biography of Frederick Douglass, and we'll talk about the papers that he found that got him rolling on this particular book. And he's written a number of other books already, including Race and Reunion, The Civil War in American Memory. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We go to Randy in Reedsburg, our first caller for you. Hi, Randy.
Yeah, hi. Very, very timely subject, and good to point this out to people right now. You know, I've thought about Douglass and had, like many, many people, had Lincoln have lived, think of what Douglass's life may, the importance, of course, it's incredibly important anyway, but what it may have taken on. Douglass had been appointed by Lincoln there at the end, a little factoid missed often. He had been appointed even Registrar of Deeds there in D.C., and imagine a white man coming to Douglass to register their property and him writing out the meets and bounds, being one of the most literate men in the area. he had gained that kind of confidence from the president, and apparently those offices in the D.C. area were the under the purview to be appointed by the president at that time.
They were, but Randy, Lincoln didn't actually appoint Douglas a recorder of deeds. That came later from President Hayes and President Garfield. We can't give Lincoln credit for that. Lincoln's gone in 65, of course, by assassination. And Douglas had to wait for... Well, actually, Douglas got a federal appointment to a commission that went to look into possible annexation of Santo Domingo, part of Haiti. That came from Grant in 1871. But it wasn't until Rutherford Hayes was elected in 1876... that Douglas was appointed to a federal office. And actually, the first office was the Marshal of the District of Columbia, which was an important office. And then later, by President Garfield, he was appointed Recorder of Deeds. And these sound like very symbolic offices, but they were very important to black Americans. Douglas was the first African American to get appointed to these kinds of important federal posts. He did become, in that sense, also after the war, very much a kind of political insider.
Right. How does that happen? He was such a critic of the government for so long. To become an insider is ironic, is it not?
Well, it's very ironic, but it also helps if your side wins a big civil war.
Right.
And your people get freed from slavery. I mean, I don't mean to be flippant, right. But he'd always wanted to be an insider. I mean, let's face it. But he cuts his teeth, of course, for 20 years as a radical outsider, always knocking on the door, never really getting in, never being inside of any political circles, until, modestly, Lincoln invites him to the White House in 1864. The first time the two met, by the way, in 63, Douglas invited himself. that's another story. But Douglas does become... he moves to Washington, indeed, by 1874, and will live in Washington the rest of his life for more than 20 years. And he did become a kind of an insider within the Republican Party, within the federal government, and he took a lot of criticism for that. A lot of younger black leaders, for example, are going to accuse him of falling out of touch. Some of them made accusations out of sheer rivalry. Some of them were really concerned that he was out of touch. Both are sort of true. He liked power. He just never had any real power except the power of the word, the power of language. And he was the first to understand that.
And that was pretty powerful. We're going to pause for a moment. We're also going to be introducing in a few moments the great... I got to make sure I get this right. The great, great, great grandson of Frederick Douglass, who will be joining us, who is the founder and president of the Frederick Douglass Family Initiatives. He's also the great, great grandson of Booker T. Washington. We're talking about Frederick Douglass this hour, and our guest who's been with us since the top of the hour is David Blight. He's a professor of history at Yale University. He's writing a biography, which should be done in 2018, of Frederick Douglass, partially because he discovered the huge number of papers that somebody had in a private collection. And so he's been pouring through those and giving us information that we haven't had before about this incredibly influential person in history. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. And this is the Ideas Network. Let me ask you, David, I don't know if you have to leave. Can you stay with us? We want to introduce the great-great-great-grandson of Frederick Douglass. Great, you can. Great. So let's do that, and both of you will be able to field more phone calls. Kenneth Morris is also joining us with the Frederick Douglass Family Initiatives. As I said, the great-great-great-grandson of Frederick Douglass, and they are doing some very interesting work, which deals with slavery in this time and human trafficking, and also planning... big celebrations, aren't you, because it's the bicentennial of your great-great-great-grandfather's birth in 2018. First of all, hi, Kenneth. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, David.
Hi, Ken. How are you?
Doing well. My good friend, David Blight.
Sure.
All right.
Good to be on with you.
Good. You two know each other. That's wonderful. So what kind of burden do you feel you have had during your lifetime to be the great-great-great-grandson? Is it only natural that you would be doing what you're doing now, or did you want to rebel against that and do something completely different with your life, Kenneth?
Early in life, I definitely rebelled against it. I mean, can you imagine being a five-year-old boy and seeing your ancestors on statues?
They're
bridges named for them. Money,
right.
They're on money. They're on stamps. Everywhere I turned, I was in their long, vast shadow. But I've definitely grown into this, and I think because I found this mission on my own, it's much more meaningful than it would have been if it were forced on me.
Mm-hmm. We've been talking about the slavery that your great-great-great-grandfather experienced. Some of the mission of what you do is dealing with slavery that exists right now throughout the world. What exists now?
Well, we looked at this issue of slavery when we were talking about starting our organization in 2007. And my good friend, whom David knows, Robert Benz, handed me a National Geographic magazine, and Robert's one of the co-founders of our organization. And the headline of the magazine was 21st Century Slaves. And I looked at that headline and reacted the way I think most people do when they hear for the first time about the existence of what's called human trafficking, but it really is modern-day slavery. And it's an issue where we find it in every civilized and uncivilized country around the world, including right here in the United States. And when we were thinking about the best way to address this, we looked at the legacies of my ancestors, and we had Frederick Douglass, who was the great abolitionist, and Booker T. Washington, who was the great educator. So we combined those legacies, and our approach is abolition through education.
Mm-hmm. And human trafficking, people will be surprised if they don't know it, that Milwaukee is one of the centers of human trafficking in the whole country.
We can find human trafficking really certainly in every major city around the country, but in many of the suburbs as well. And we really thought that if we were going to go about educating the public on the existence of human trafficking, now in the public consciousness, people thought that slavery had ended with the work of Frederick Douglass and the abolitionists and the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation. But we thought that the best place to start educating the public about this, where I think education should start, and that's with young people in schools.
Mm-hmm. Both of you, and let's start with you on this, David, that you're publishing your book, I understand, will come out during the bicentennial of Douglass's birth next year.
That's the hope.
Well, it'll be done.
I got the draft done. Now I got to revise.
All right. Well, that only takes a day, right?
Yeah,
probably not. Tell me, both of you, about the works that you're going to be presenting. I know that the area that the Family Initiative is also going to be publishing a special book in 2018 as well. Could you start talking about that, and then David will talk about your book and how you came about doing it? Kenneth, with you first.
Yes. Well, Frederick Douglass's bicentennial is in 2018. And my whole life, I have had people of all ages and all races come up to me, sometimes with tears in their eyes, to talk about how Frederick Douglass's first autobiography, The Narrative, published in 1845, how that impacted their lives. And many people have said to me, you know, I would love to thank Frederick Douglass in person, but because I can't, you're my conduit to him. And as a young boy, it was really hard to try and wrap my mind around this idea that so many people were connected to my ancestor in such an emotional way. So we have decided to republish his narrative, the special bicentennial edition, and we're going to give that book to 1 million young people around the country. And we heard David talk earlier about Frederick Douglass and his time in Baltimore and when his slave mistress Sophia began to teach him how to read and write. And his master would say, you cannot teach a slave how to read and write, because if you do, it will unfit him to be a slave. And Frederick heard that message, and he knew that if his master didn't want him to have this knowledge, that education would be his pathway to freedom. And as he begins to teach himself to read and write, and he starts to think critically about his condition of enslavement and oppression, and he would ask God, am I meant to be a slave for life? And so in the same way that Frederick Douglass started to think critically about his condition, we want young people who are inspired by his words to start to think about how they can affect change in their communities around issues of systemic racism. And you know, Douglas, when he would eventually get to New Bedford, Massachusetts, and start working with William Lloyd Garrison, he looked back and he saw that there was this institution of legalized slavery that needed to be dismantled. And we would love for young people to use that example to look at these institutions that oppress them and look and start to come up with some strategies on how they can start to dismantle these institutions. So this is really a project about literacy. It's a project about social service and action, because Douglas, when he got to New Bedford, he could have looked back and he could have said, well, you know, I'm here, I'm married, we can start a family, I'm going to start working. But no, he didn't do that. He took action, and we would like to see 1 million people in the mold, or 1 million young people in the mold of Frederick Douglass.
Mm. And David, your book, it's an interesting story how you decided to write it with all this new material you found.
Yeah, well, I was very fortunate, and Ken knows all about this because he's been there himself. There's a collector of African-American art and literature and manuscripts named Walter Evans, who lives in Savannah, Georgia, of all places. That's where he grew up. And he moved north to go to medical school, and he was a very successful surgeon in Detroit. But Walter started collecting, decades ago, and he has an amazing collection of Douglass material, especially family scrapbooks. Also a lot of family photos and letters. And some 6 or 7 years ago, at least, I went to Savannah to give a talk about Douglass's narrative, which I've done many times, to a group of junior and high school teachers. And the host said, there's this local gentleman who's a collector who'd like to go to lunch, and that's how I met Walter. He took me to his home, put out on his dining room table parts of his Douglass collection, and that's how I decided then, okay, I better do this. And most of the collection is, by the way, post-Civil War. It covers the last third, the last 30 or 35 years of Douglass's life, and it provides a remarkable window into the older Douglass's life and work, and especially into his family life, his extended family, which was very complicated. As Ken knows, he's a product of it. It was that process then of going to Savannah many times. I've spent at least 4 spring breaks there and many, many other weeks working in Walter's collection that not only convinced me to write the new biography, but that's in great part how I did it. And it's especially the latter part of Douglass's life, the last third, the post-war, the older man, that I don't think most people tend to know much about. The younger, heroic Douglass, we tend to grow up learning about now, at least, well, most of us have. Perhaps President Trump didn't. But it's that older Douglass that is so fascinating, and because he's juggling not only this business of being an insider and an outsider, but he's juggling a huge extended family, that much of which is dependent on him. He holds these federal appointments. But he's also maintaining a back-breaking lecture-touring life right on to the last months of his life at age 77 that boggles the imagination. Mm. He would do wintertime speaking tours of 3 months or 4 months. He would deliver 30, 40, 50 lectures on these tours all over the Midwest. It's partly how he made a living, but it's also because he was so sought after.
Right.
In fact, I venture a guess in the book, I can't prove it, probably more Americans heard Frederick Douglass as a speaker than any other American.
Isn't that remarkable? And we'll ask you, Kenneth, we have a number of people who have called in, so we want to get to some phone calls, but keep in the back of your mind, Kenneth, because I'll ask you in a few minutes about stories that have been handed down about your great-great-great-grandfather, because those will be great to hear. Let's go to some phone calls. Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi. This is a wonderful program. These days, I'm really paying attention to people trying to communicate with me as they tweet at me. and I'll leave the comment that comment as it is. But I'm wondering if there's a Frederick Douglass Museum, because the little bit of contact I've had with Douglass's writing, I find so powerful and so moving. And Kathleen, you led us on that wonderful tour to Gettysburg,
yes,
and D.C., and I went to the Jefferson Monument and the Lincoln Monument, and I stand in the presence of these human beings whose words are engraved. And I'm just thinking, is there somewhere that I could plan a trip to Frederick Douglass?
Yeah, Kenneth, I'm sure, will know of some places. Kenneth, where should he go?
Well, he should go to the Frederick Douglass National Historic Site in Washington, D.C. It's in the Anacostia neighborhood, and that's where he spent the last 17 years of his life. And I was actually born in Washington, D.C., and I remember being a little boy and visiting that house on field trips.
Oh.
And I love to go into his library, because you can see all of the books that are in there from the ceiling to the floor. And when you stop to think that this was a man who never spent any time in a classroom, and he was a self-taught scholar.
Yes.
And then if you go upstairs, my favorite room in the house is his bedroom. And if you look inside the bedroom, on his bed, you will see his nightshirt. Next to the bed on a chair is his hat, and on the floor is a pair of his shoes. And when I was a little boy, I always wanted to step into those shoes to try them on for size. And so that's one place that you can go. Another place is the
Highland. And Ken, you only left out the little barbells there, too.
Oh, yeah, right.
You have little barbells.
Well, why don't you share about the barbells and how he worked out? The other place that you should visit is Highland Beach, Maryland. And Frederick Douglass's youngest son, Charles, who is my great-great-grandfather, founded this town, and he purchased 17 acres of land and then saved one of the plots to build a retirement home for his father. And when he asked his dad about some special features, his dad wanted it to point in a certain direction because it was right on the Chesapeake Bay. And if you look back across the water on the other side, you can see land. And that's where he was born into slavery, on the eastern shore of Maryland. And he wanted to sit at the top of the house in a place that he called the tower, where he could look back across that water. And this is a great lesson for young people when we talk about history. You know, I think history is important for a lot of reasons, but I think it's most important that we need to know where we've come from in order to know where we're headed. And here was a man who had been born into slavery, and he just never wanted to forget where he had come from. In that house now, I spent all of my summers as a boy in that house at the knee of my great-grandmother, Fanny Douglass, who was married to his grandson, Joseph. Mm-hmm. My great-grandmother, Fanny, lived to be 103 years old, and I used to sit on her knee, and she would tell me about meeting Frederick Douglass as a little girl in Atlanta, about 8 years old. So even with all of those greats, as you introduced me, I can say I stand just one person away from Frederick Douglass, and I stand one person away from history and from slavery.
Mm. And you have indeed stepped into those shoes that you saw and wanted to step into them at that museum.
Thank you.
Let's go. Thank you, Rich. Does that answer your question, sir? Yeah. Rich, thanks so much for your call. Kathleen in Madison. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi there. I have a question. I wonder if they'd comment about Douglass in Ireland. I'm real interested in Ireland, and I read last year that on his way to England, he spent months in Ireland.
Yeah, he did.
That it was the first time he felt free,
yeah,
and that he was really influenced by the liberator Daniel O'Connell.
Mm. Right, indeed. Well, when he takes the steamer to Liverpool for the first time in 1845, he immediately crossed the Irish Sea into Dublin. He spent 4 months in Dublin on that first tour, and he loved it. He loved it in Ireland, and by and large, they loved him. There was even a new edition of his narrative published in Dublin. He went south to Cork, spent a lot of time in Cork, went up through the center of Ireland, and then spent a good deal of time up in Belfast, gave lots of speeches in Ireland. He was also there, as you may know, at the very beginnings of the great famine, the terrible potato famine, and he saw poverty in the particularly rural roadsides of Ireland like he had never quite seen in America. It had a great impact on him. And there are now memorials in
Ireland to Douglas. There are at least two major books that have been written about Douglas in Ireland. He only spent about 4 months there, but although he revisited there, I believe, on his European tour that he made with his second wife in the 1880s. But Ireland had a real impact on him, particularly, I think, as did Scotland, by the way. The stories of the Scottish and of the Irish and their resistance to British monarchy, the ecclesiastical struggles and battles of the Irish and the Scots fascinated him. He had a real affinity with the Irish and the Scots in particular. Of course, he chose his name from a Sir Walter Scott novel.
More phone calls in just one moment. We're talking about Frederick Douglass this hour of the program, and we have two distinguished guests with us. Kenneth Morris is the great-great-great-grandson of Frederick Douglass and the great-great-grandson of Booker T. Washington. He's the founder and president of the Frederick Douglass Family Initiatives, and his latest books include Picturing Frederick Douglass and the bicentennial edition of Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, an American Slave. David Blight is a historian. His special area is Frederick Douglass and the Civil War. He is at Yale University. He is the director of the Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition. And he is the author of Race and Reunion, The Civil War in American Memory, to mention just one of his books. More phone calls momentarily here on the Ideas Network. Gentlemen, do you recommend, both of you, well, we'll all read what comes out for 2018, but for those, and I would imagine there are more than a few, including some national leaders who have forgotten about the extraordinary life of Frederick Douglass, where does one begin to learn about him? What should we read what he wrote about himself first?
Well, I think that's probably the best way. The narrative itself, the first narrative, is short. It's a classic. It's now taught very widely in schools and certainly in colleges. But also the second autobiography called My Bondage and My Freedom, published in 1855, is a marvelous read. It's Douglass's long-form masterpiece. I would recommend first reading Douglass in his own words. And for those who get hooked, there are many published collections now of Douglass's speeches, his editorials. He is a voice and a critic of and a lover of American institutions and its creeds like no other in the 19th century. I'd suggest starting with his own words.
Kenneth, what do you say?
Yeah, absolutely. I suggest starting with his own words and our upcoming special edition Bicentennial, which we will have out in a few weeks. And in that Bicentennial, we've made it available to a younger audience, and Brian Stevenson, who is the founder and CEO of the Equal Justice Initiative, he works around issues of mass incarceration, and he's written a brilliant introduction which talks about Frederick Douglass and the time when he was writing the narrative, and then he goes through Jim Crow all the way up into mass incarceration, so young people can make that connection from this legal institution of slavery to this idea that slavery is legal today in the form of mass incarceration and prisons and the private prison system.
And somebody needs to do, I'm thinking of some of the other films that have been done, but wouldn't it be nice if we saw just a wonderful feature-length documentary that became very, very popular about Frederick Douglass next year? Like, you know, Jackie Robinson had a film.
Oh, that would be wonderful. I've been working for 20 years with a group of producers trying to get that very film made.
Have you, really?
And we've come very, very close, but it hasn't quite happened yet. But stay tuned.
Ooh.
Well, and also stay tuned on our end as well. David, I need to talk to you about something. I haven't had a chance to talk to you about that. But,
Wait a second. What is it? Tell us when it happens, okay?
Yes, we definitely will. You'll have to have us both back on, and we can talk about it.
Well, I'll have you both back on any old time. You're great, and I'm sorry that our time is up, but thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen. Good to hear you, Ken.
Yes, yes. Thank you, Kathleen. Talk to you soon, David.
All right, thanks.
Our pleasure to have you both on. Our thanks to Kenneth Morris, the great-great-great-grandson of Frederick Douglass, great-great-grandson of Booker T. Washington. He is the founder and president of the Frederick Douglass Family Initiatives. We'll have to hear what the two have up their sleeves, and I'll let you know as soon as I know. David Blight is a teacher, scholar, public historian at Yale University, and he's working right now on a biography of Frederick Douglass, which will come out during the bicentennial year, which happens to be 2018. Actually, it'll be out, I would imagine, a little before then. Thanks so much to Scotty Myers for producing this extraordinarily interesting program, and thanks to Colleen Duvall for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Just a reminder, tomorrow during this time period, former U.S. Poet Laureate Billy Collins has a new book of poetry. He will be with us to read some of that poetry, and we'll have great fun talking with him tomorrow, and that will be after 2 o'clock. Thanks for listening. Thanks for your phone calls and for all of your interest. Until mañana.